Is Jesus the Truth? The fifth talk in a series titled Christianity and Truth was presented by Wes Hurd on October 23, 2001, at an evening class of McKinsey Study Center, an institute of Gutenberg College. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2012. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved. A brief break occurs in the middle of the following recording. It is the result of the original audio tape switching to the second side.
Welcome to the series on Christianity and Truth. The series on Tuesday nights has been concerned with and more or less designed to promote a perspective that we share here among the teaching staff and faculty at McKinsey Study Center and Gutenberg College, a perspective that we can take on the relationship between being Christian, believing the message of Christ, the gospel, and pursuing and knowing truth, just truth in general. Why? What's the big deal? It's because in today's philosophical climate, it's easy to slip into the view that we shouldn't make a big deal of the truthful character of the claims of the faith, of Christian faith. Rather, we should emphasize the character of the story. That is, what happened, what was said, and then, if it seems truthful and striking and plausible to me personally, then go ahead and believe it. If it doesn't seem plausible to someone, or doesn't seem plausible to someone else, then its truthfulness isn't compelling to them, and we shouldn't get all uptight about that. In other words, it's a very subjective. Today's climate and atmosphere, philosophically, socially, culturally, is an atmosphere in which it's very easy to be not uptight about truth. That truth is when I do that and I make that truth, people, it makes people nervous in the climate that we live in today. That's definitely not the character and the claim, I would argue, of the Bible's claims about its perspective on man and God and the universe and the cosmos and reality. In other words, the Bible is making a very straight-ahead, exclusivistic claim about what is true truth. In the series on Tuesday nights, we started off with Jack Crabtree doing a sketch of the history of truth, which, by the way, these are on tape if you're interested in getting one that you haven't been able to attend. Jack sort of talked us through the philosophical history, or the history of philosophy regarding the truth in sort of big swashbuckling brushstrokes, and it was very helpful. And then David Crabtree the next week talked about the issue of can we know truth. It was sort of it was definitely a talk about how do we know, and what basis do we know, a talk about epistemology, and just sort of a commonsensical approach to how do we address this issue of truthfulness today, and what is truth today in the climate that we live in. And then last week, Ron asked the question, can we believe the Bible because it is reliable or true historically? And he did that by taking on the issues that have been raised by the so-called Jesus Seminar, which is a group of scholars that have received a high-profile of media about their work. Ron's concerns were pointed at what he saw as the problem the Jesus Seminar raises in that it embodies a view of skepticism, a serious skeptical view toward the reliability of the biblical texts. At the core of the Bible's message for us is the claim that its message is true. If the texts are unreliable or corrupted beyond repair, or if they are just simply well-intended fictions written by people who followed Jesus several decades after he was actually here, then our confidence in the message of the Bible, from the texts of the Bible, is seriously impaired and undermined. So that's why Ron took on that topic. Now, the next step, which is what I'm going to do tonight, is talk about, as Nancy said, the subject of, is Jesus the truth? And what does that mean? The Bible's claim is that its view of man and reality and what's real and good and true and valuable and what's evil, in other words, that the span of reality, that its claim is that it's absolutely accurate. In other words, the spirit of the Bible's message to us is that we ought to believe it because it is actually true, not just because it fits my mental frame or makes me feel safe and comfortable, but it's because it's true. In other words, it's true. The Bible is claiming to be true for all people at all times. It's that kind of truth. So along those lines and following from that, then, I want to address two primary questions tonight. One, if the Bible is claiming to be the truth, and if Jesus is the central and culminating figure of the Bible, then what is the relation of Jesus to truth? In the grand scheme of things, what does the man Jesus have to do with the truth? If truth is ultimately, in other words, if truth is ultimately a description, and this is a technical philosophical way of saying this, but simple, but took me a while to get my head around it. If truth is ultimately a description or of a proposition or a statement, that is what is being stated or claimed by a proposition or a statement, does it in fact correspond to what is the case? In other words, if I say ice is cold, does the statement ice is cold correspond to the fact of whether ice is cold? In other words, truth is basically a statement or a proposition that is alleging for something to be the case. It's a fact. It's something we ought to believe because it's true. If that's the case, then what does the Bible's view of truth, or in what sense does Jesus, in a text I'm going to look at tonight, being proclaimed as the truth, what does that mean? How do we put that together? If Jesus does have, and then the second question is this. So the first question is, what do we mean by Jesus being the truth, or what is that about? And secondly, if Jesus does have some central role or relationship to truth for all mankind, in a universal sense, do we have to believe him or the Bible's claims about him, or his claims that we find in the text of the Bible? Do we have to believe that in order to find God's favor or to enter the kingdom of God? In other words, what about this issue of Jesus being the only way? How do we deal with that? So those are the two questions I want to deal with. So I'd like to talk about how we can view the relationship between the person, the claims, the teachings of Jesus, to the concept of truth. Now, I could go immediately to a verse that I do want to deal with tonight, which is the verse from John, the Gospel of John, chapter 14, verse 6, which is the famous statement that's often pulled out by Christians, saying, where Jesus said, "I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father but by me." But I want to hold off on that, because that is a central verse that I want to talk about. But I want to hold off on that and go to two other passages. One, both of them in John, actually, the Gospel of John. And then come back to that one, because I think in going to the other passages first, we'll have a better grip on what is really meant by the statement that Jesus made about for himself about being the truth. So let's do that first. So if you have a Bible and you want to go there with me, I'm going to go to John chapter 1. The Gospel of John chapter 1. John is an interesting gospel. You may already know this, but just a little bit of background on John. John was the last gospel written. John wrote his gospel probably 20 to 25 years after the deaths of some of the disciples or the apostles that were martyred. Thus, he has this perspective on the whole thing as an old man, looking back, reading the culture, going through all these experiences of the early church, and he writes his gospel not as Matthew, Mark, and Luke did to particular audiences. John's gospel is much more general in a sense, and the language that he uses is both simple, very simple Greek, almost baby-like Greek, and very symbolic, highly metaphoric. And in the first chapter of his gospel, as a matter of fact, it turns out, I was looking around a little bit and found out that John's gospel actually touches on 30 days of Jesus' life. That's how sort of abbreviated it is. But I think we can attribute the reason for that to the fact that John has this perspective on what kind of information, what kind of emphasis is needed in order to sort of fill in what the other Gospels have. Now, surely he's had access to the other Gospels. And so he writes not only out of the fabric of his own personality and his own vision and his own times, but he also is looking at what hasn't been said and how should I say it in a way that I think I, John, will accomplish what I want in a particular kind of way. And so his language is very, very characteristic of him. You can see it both in his gospel and in his two epistles. In the first 13 or 14 verses of the Gospel of John is called the prologue. I'm going to read through this, and then I'm going to pull out some things from the prologue that I think are very significant issues connecting the person of Jesus to the issue of truth. So, here we go. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was in the beginning with God. All things came into being through him, and apart from him nothing came into being that has come into being. In him was life, and the life was the light of men. And the light shines in the darkness, and the darkness did not comprehend it or overcome it. There came a man sent from God whose name was John, that is, John the Baptist. He came for a witness, that he might bear witness of the light, that all might believe through him. He was not the light, but he came that he might bear witness of the light. There was the true light, which coming into the world enlightens every man. He was in the world, and the world was made through him, and the world did not know him. Because he came to his own, and those who were his own did not receive him. But as many as received him, to them he gave the right to become the children of God, even to those that believe on his name, who were born not of blood, nor of the will of flesh, nor of the will of man, but of God. And the Word became flesh and dwelt among us, and we beheld his glory, the glory as of the only begotten from the Father, full of grace and truth. That little section is called the prologue. I want to say a few things about it. First of all, there's no way that I can try to deal with everything that's in this passage, but I want to highlight some particular things that I think are pertinent to the issue of truth in relation to Jesus. But it's interesting how this passage is almost like, it bumps up against almost being a poetry. It's so symbolic and so clear and in some ways so cryptic and simple that it almost borders on, it has a very poetic feel to it. And what he's doing in these first 13, 14 verses is actually laying out in very simple, cryptic, abbreviated form, in very symbolic language, he's laying out what he's going to talk about the rest of the gospel. In other words, the whole message of the purpose of Jesus' life, his coming, his life, his death, burial, and resurrection, and what he taught is sort of encoded in these brief words that we have here. So, John is outlining, in a sense, the entire gospel in this very simple, highly symbolic, metaphoric language. The first thing I want to point out is in verse 1, it says, in the beginning was the Word. The Word is the term, the Greek term, logos. This term, in this term, John chooses a word that is extremely important and conceptually important to the audience that he has and that he is writing his letter for. This term was very, very loaded, pregnant with implications that John is going to employ in trying to communicate what he wants to communicate here about who Jesus is. The term is loaded with, the background to it is that it's loaded with the Hellenistic and even particularly the Stoic philosophers, the way they use this word and the way the word would have been understood in general Hellenistically influenced culture of the day is that the logos in Greek Stoic terms stood for the concept of the controlling, creative, rational, and purposive principle that stands above all things and out of which it is the beginning of history. It's the source of the beginning of history. The logos forms the founding, the creative reality, and the principle of the cosmos. It forms the rational infrastructure and ordering of the cosmos. It forms the creation principle upon which everything in existence depends on for its existence. And it is rational. It is understandable. It is coherent. It is communicable. It is knowable. Now, David, in his talk, already spent some time on this, so I'm not going to spend a great deal of time on it, but I want to introduce the term because we have to go from the logos progressively through this passage to the other terms that help us understand this. But conceptually, I think John has selected a term in which truth itself is grounded. The idea of the existence of reality is grounded in the term logos. And it is a term that is attempting to describe, in a sense, God. Now, it's not being used in the Greek terms in the personal God, creating God of the universe that we have in the Bible, but it is trying to say something about God that John believes, and apparently biblically in God's worldview, is actually accurate to the fact about God. In other words, the ordering, causative, rational principle upon which all of reality is grounded is this logos. He says, in the beginning was the logos. This logos was in the beginning with God. All things came into being through the logos. Apart from the logos, nothing has come into being that has come into being. In the logos was life, and the life was the light of men. Let me take that on for a second. In the Logos was life. And I think here what we have is another very full-bodied, pregnant term. In the Logos was this notion of life. Life in biblical terms, the word life in biblical terms, is the metaphor for the greatest end of man, the ultimate end and purpose of the creation and existence of mankind, humankind, the creature. Life is what the creature, man and woman, was created for in biblical terms. It is when we ask the question, what are we here for? Why do we exist? The quick one-word answer is life. Again, I don't want to spend too much time on this, but the notion basically embodies the idea, the word embodies the notion of the opposite of death. In biblical terms, death is the result of the alienation of man from God, the corruption of the creature, the brokenness of the creature, the fallenness of the creature, and consequently, the ultimate evil impact, the impact of evil on the creature, such that the human creature embodies evil. That we have evil at work within us, as Paul proclaims in the 7th chapter of Romans. In other words, he says, I see this principle then, that evil, that sin, evil is at work with me deep at the very core of my being. And he cries out in helplessness, what can I do about this? Death is in a sense, the moral entropy, the breaking down of what ought to be, what is good and true and valuable. Death is the opposite. It's the breaking down, the diffusion, the entropy of that notion. So we have these sort of opposite terms in this macro motif in the biblical cosmology. On the one hand, we have death, which is the breakdown of all that is good, the corruption of all that is good, and ultimately the demise of all that is good. And life is its opposite, where everything is good. Life is good. It is fulfillment. Where everything is built up, everything grows in beauty and goodness. Everything that touches is fulfilled in the truest sense of what that word can mean. In the Logos was this life. In other words, inherent in the notion of the ultimate purposive structure and reason for the existence of all things is this notion of life. It's what things were created for. And then it says, the life was the light of men. And I think what's meant here in this is that this notion of ultimate fulfillment, life, is the fulfillment of the human creature. Life is what the creature was made for. The life was the light of men. The life is the fulfillment of men, of mankind. So, the life was the light of men. What do we need to be enlightened about? I'm getting ahead of myself here. Now I want to focus on another verse. It talks about John here, John the Baptist. He came for a witness, that he might bear witness of the light, that he might believe through him, John was not the light, but that he came that he might bear witness of the light. And then in verse 9, we have a continuation of the notion of this logic here, where he says, there was the true light, which coming into the world enlightens every man. And we can ask the question, if life then becomes a light. In verse 4, it says, in the Logos was the life, and the life was the light of men. In this sense, I'm taking what he means there, as he's using light there, it's the fulfillment. But in verse 9, I think John is switching gears a bit, and he's using the term in a slightly different way. He's saying, there was the true light, which coming into the world enlightens every man. Here, I think he's using the light, the word light, in the sense of truth. That is, the truth about reality, the truth about being human. So here, life is the light, and in verse 4, it's the fulfillment of human being. It's the ultimate fulfillment of our being. And in verse 9, he switches and uses it a little different way. And here, I think he's using the word as enlightenment. That is, the truth about us. The emphasis on the truth. There was the true light coming into the world which enlightens every man. In other words, this concept of light is able to turn... It delivers for mankind information that enlightens him as to the truth of his existence, the core truth of his existence. Now, there are all kinds of needs for truth that we have. The question is, what do we need to be enlightened about? If we put it this way, and sort of, this is a really simple way to look at it, but we have needs for physical material existence. We need to know the truth about what it takes to survive, to be, in the physical material sense. So we need to be enlightened about that. We need to have that understanding. There's another sense in which we need to, going a little deeper, we have a need for intellectual or mental fulfillment or information. It's really helpful to have information about the world and how it works and how society works, how culture works, how human beings interact. And a lot of that goes well beyond the physical. It goes into the psychological. It goes into all that whole range of knowledge. And we need information and truth about that. But there's something more critical at the core of human existence. It's the question that in today's climate, I think, has actually become kind of almost, I'm going to say a joke exactly. On one level, people, I think, jest about it. That is, what are we here for? What's the meaning of man? I mean, I say that in that tone and in that sort of sarcastic, silly tone because I think in today's climate, everybody's sort of given up on that. I mean, if you're a true postmodern thinker, that question is ultimately unanswerable. Postmodernist thought is so committed to the notion that there is no way that we could ever find out something like that, that to ask the question is absurd. So it's asked in that sense. I'm suggesting that it's asked in our cartoons, in our joking, in our in a sort of half serious tone. And yet, underneath that, built into the very structure of who we are as creatures, as human beings, there is this deep, undeniable reality of desperately wanting to know, what are we here for? In other words, who am I, and do I mean anything? And am I going anywhere? Is there any direction and flow and purpose and meaning to what my life and existence is about? The existential questions that were asked in the early part of this century have been put away. And we can't go into all the details on why. But essentially, that's the place that we're in today. But it's those questions that we need to be enlightened about. And I think that what John is getting at here is that there's a connection between the logos, the notion and concept of fulfillment in life, and the enlightenment that we need to have about that, that lies at the very core of our existence and who we are and the deepest sense of identity and sense of reason for existence. So it's that kind of information that lies here at the very core. It's the questions of the meaning of existence, the reason for existence, and the direction and purpose of existence. Are there any answers to those questions? So the understanding that comes from the logos and the connection of the logos to this notion of life, and the connection of the enlightenment of light, that as he's using that term here, to enlighten every human being that is capable of enlightening every human that exists. The result of that true understanding of being in existence is what the true light is about. He's talking about in Romans, in John 1:9 here. The true light he uses the sense of the true light, and it's interesting because I think that the idea behind the words he used here is that this is the light that outshines all the little lights. There are lots of little lights that inform us. This is the origin of light. This is the true light. This is the source of all lights that enlighten us and help us. So in that sense, it's the true originating light. Now, so here is the connection. Here's the first clue made. Here are the clues that we're putting together as to the connection between Jesus and the truth. What he taught, his perspectives, is what we could call what this passage and what the Bible is calling the truth. Jesus, as it goes on in verse 14, the Logos became flesh and dwelt among us, and we beheld his glory, the glory as of the only begotten from the Father, full of grace and truth. Now here's this, okay, so here we culminate and we summarize in this connection between the Logos, the life, the light, and then the Word, the Logos becoming flesh and living among us. And then he definitely identifies at the 14th verse, he definitely identifies Jesus as the Logos. In other words, his identity is connected to the Logos. So there's something about Jesus, that is connected to this originating, creating, purposive, rational, ordering Lord of the cosmos. When we understand this, the Bible would argue, I think, when we understand this and when we embrace it ourselves, personally, existentially, we embrace it as the vision of the life, as the core of the vision that forms where we're going in life, how we think about life, why we're doing life. When we embrace that, we are in possession not only of the most important piece of truth that we could ever have, but we see here the connection between having and pursuing what is true with the life of Jesus Christ. In other words, there's this connection between Jesus, the person, and truth for life. Truth that forms the core of where we're going in life and what life is all about. So, now I want to move to another passage. Before I come back to that John 14:6, because I think it helps put a little bit more information in the bucket here for us. In John chapter 8, there's a passage from verses about 21 to 32, which I'll read. Here Jesus is in dialogue with the Pharisees in the temple. Jesus has been teaching in the temple. And he says, he said therefore to them again, I go away, and you shall seek me, and you shall die in your sin. Where I am going, you cannot come. Therefore the Jews were saying, surely he will not kill himself, will he? Since he says, where I am going, you cannot come. And he was saying to them, you are from below, I am from above. You are of this world, I am not of this world. I said therefore to you, that you shall die in your sins, for unless you believe that I am, you shall die in your sins. So they were saying to him, who are you? And Jesus said to them, what have I been saying to you from the beginning? I have many things to speak and to judge concerning you, but he who sent me is true. And the things which I heard from him, these I speak to the world. They did not realize that he was speaking to them about the Father, about God. Jesus said, therefore said, when you lift up the Son of Man, then you will know that I am he. I do nothing on my own initiative, but I speak these things as the Father taught me. And he who sent me is with me, and he has not left me alone, for I always do the things that are pleasing to him. And as he spoke these things, many came to believe in him. Jesus, therefore, was saying to those Jews who had believed in him, if you abide in my word, then you are truly disciples of mine, and you shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free. Now, over the library doors here at the university is a statement, and the truth shall make you free. Of course, it's pulled out of the context from which it is found. But here we have a really, I think, important bit of information about how we think about Jesus and the truth, or how we think about the Bible and truth. What kind of truth is it? I mean, there's truth that... there's truth about how bumblebees fly, because they're not supposed to fly. They're too big. There's truth about that. There's truth about... the biological truth, there's psychological, there's all kinds of truth out there. So when the Bible claims to be truth, and Jesus in particular, as the central figure of the Bible, says, I am the truth, what does that mean? What kind of truth is that? What does it have to do with? Well, it has to do with these central core questions. That's the truth he's talking about. And the clue we have from this passage is, when he, in this little cryptic passage, he says, you shall know that if you abide in my word, then you are truly disciples of mine. In other words, if you listen to what I teach and you embrace it, you are my disciples, and the truth that I give you will make you free. I need to go on a little bit further. And their answer to him, we are Abraham's offspring and have never been enslaved to anyone. How is it that you say we shall become free? And Jesus answered them, truly, truly, I say to you, everyone who commits sin is a slave of sin. And the slave does not remain in the house forever. The son does remain forever. If therefore the son shall make you free, you shall be free indeed. The thrust of what he's after here, I think, is that the nature of the true truth, the critical truth, the truth that enlightens every man, the truth that we must have, that we all yearn for, is the truth that tells us two things. One, it tells us about our true condition and nature, that we are slaves to sin, that we're caught and trapped in the power of death, and that we are corrupted by it. And two, we have a great need to be redeemed from it, to be saved from it, to be given new life. It's all the questions and issues that center on those questions that characterize what we're talking about when we talk about the identification of Jesus and truth. It's not that there isn't other truth. It's that this particular truth is the most important truth that exists for us. If we don't have this truth, we are lost. So it is the beginning of understanding and truth out from which we can build an understanding of being human, of reality, of the cosmos, of man in social and cultural settings, etc. This is the truth that we must have. This is the truth that man needs to be enlightened about. And the connection with Jesus here becomes clear as we turn to the next passage, which is the one that I've been talking about earlier, John 14. So let's talk about that for a moment. John 14, we have this somewhat classic, famous verse. It's interesting, and it's important to set the context for this verse. This is the one where Jesus says, "I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father but by me." I want to take it on in two parts. But at first, I want to give the context for the statement. Jesus is with his disciples. His disciples are about to go into the catastrophic, cataclysmic shock of their lives. They've been following Jesus for 3 years, listening to him, growing in their understanding, getting more and more convinced that he is the Messiah, that they're following the truth. But he is about to go to his death. He is about to be betrayed. He's with his disciples in the last upper room discourse, and he gives them this information. He says, let not your heart be troubled. Believe in God. Believe also in me. In my Father's house there are many dwelling places. If it were not so, I would have told you, for I go to prepare a place for you. And if I go to prepare a place for you, I will come again and receive you to myself, that where I am, you may be also. And you know the way where I am going. And Thomas said to him, Lord, we do not know where you are going. How do we know the way? And Jesus said to him, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father but through me. So the context for this statement is that Jesus knows his disciples are about to get rattled to the core of their existence. And the faith and trust, the belief that they have had in him and in what he has been teaching about God, about man, about sin, about life, about what's important, about these things, is about to be shaken down to the foundations by his betrayal, arrest, execution, and death. And so he says, don't be troubled. What he means by that is, I'm sure they reflected back on this, and that's why John wrote this. When he says, don't let your heart be troubled, what he means by that is, don't let the coming events shake you out of your understanding, out of what I have told you about what is true. So the context is, he's trying to, in this cryptic little way, the way, the truth, and the life, he's simply summarizing, as he is wont to do in his style of writing and communicating the gospel, he is summarizing in a very short, brief way, and reminding, Jesus is reminding them who he is. Now he says, I am the way, and I think quite simply what he means by that is that he is the means, he is the path to the truth. It's his life and his existence that provides the path to this core truth that we have to understand. He is the way. And then he says, I am the truth. And what does he mean by that? Well, you know, there is a kind of popular understanding floating around out there in the church that is basically something along the lines of, well, Jesus is the truth, and the truth is not facts. The truth is a person. Well, I don't think that's what he's after here. I think what he's after is that, quite simply, what I have taught you, What I have taught you is the truth. What I have taught you is true. Of all the possible messages of hope and destiny and truth about what who man is and what we need to do in this life and how we get fulfilled, what I have taught you is the truth. So he is the means to the truth, and what he is teaching them is the truth. And secondly, and the second part of this, is to take on this little cryptic statement, no one comes to the Father but by me, and that's the major question I want to end with tonight. Here we come to that, what in the postmodern perspective is this most irritating exclusiveness of Jesus. This is just audacious. No one can come to God but by me. I mean, this really hacks people off. And it's that only his view of God is the absolutely, unfailingly true, unfailingly dependable view of reality. That he is that truth, that what he's teaching is that truth. And that his action in life, his behavior and his action of laying down his life provided a glorious, unique, and sufficient appeal to God for forgiveness and life for humankind. And it was sufficient. And it was unique. No one else did this. So in that sense, it's appropriate, given kind of the connection of everything I've been saying tonight, or trying to say, is that Jesus forms this central, pivotal, critical role of information for the human being, for the human race. The nature of which is that only it is able to qualify us for salvation. It's the only message that clears us, that gets us into the kingdom of God, into the kingdom of heaven. It's that kind of exclusive, the nature of who he was, what he taught, and what he did, taken all together, forms the central issue, the central potential for man to be made again, over again, into the creature that God intends for him, created him for. So, do we have to know Jesus or hear about Jesus? What is it we have to believe about Jesus in order to be someone who is in the process of being saved by God? Well, there's a sense in which we do, I mean, the question is, do we have to physically hear it? Do we have to hear of him before it can be said of us that we believe and trust in God for salvation? Well, there's a yes and a no to that question, I think. Yes, in the sense that given who Jesus is and the absolutely unique nature of what only he could do for the human being, it is appropriate that the Bible says every knee will bow and ought to bow and call him the Lord of the cosmos. Jesus is the most important being in God's creation. And eventually, all of creation will acknowledge that. But it's not quite as simple. It's not just hearing the message or understanding what Jesus did. It's not just hearing that information and those facts. There's more to it. For example, in Romans chapter 4, Paul lifts up the character of Abraham, the figure of Abraham, as an example of someone who was saved by faith. Now, we know that Abraham existed well before the specific information about Jesus was available to him. And we know from scanning chapter 11 of the book of Hebrews that the writer to the Hebrews outlines a whole bunch of people in the Old Testament who were saved by faith, who were found favor in God's eyes, and who received the promise of life on the basis of their faith, who did not have a complete understanding and picture of who Jesus was, or what, how Jesus was going to fit into this picture, or how God was going to accomplish his work of saving, of offering salvation to mankind. So how does that work? Well, I think the picture is that Abraham, the information that God had about Abraham, the true information that Abraham got, that Abraham had about God, was information that he embraced authentically, truly, and completely. What Abraham did understand about the God of the Bible, the God who was there, is he embraced. He believed. And he didn't just do it in his head. He didn't just acknowledge it with some sort of assent to it. He actually walked out of Ur and followed God to a new destiny, a new destination that he didn't know where he was going. He was just following the God who had spoken to him. And in so acting, he demonstrated the quality of his belief, his faith in that God. That was the true God, and he believed the vision of life, the vision and promise that God had given to him personally, even though it didn't present a full, complete picture that we have today. The quality of Abraham's faith is used by Paul the Apostle in the book of Romans as an example of genuine faith. Genuine saving faith. So how do we conclude this? How do we bring this to some closure? It seems like the picture is that it's not what we know, but it's how we know it and embrace it. In other words, being creatures, being persons who love truth and who will follow true truth when they hear it, being persons who love truth is ultimately the quality of belief that God embraces, that God accepts. Let me see if I can do a kind of a little picture of this. Seems to me that what's going on when we believe, again, just to summarize this, why am I going into this? If Jesus is the truth, do we have to know about Jesus specifically and clearly? Is it appropriate that we do? Yes. Do we physically have to? Well, it seems to me that what's going on when we, like Abraham, believe true information about the God who is there, is that we understand and embrace several facts. First of all, God is there, and that God is good, and God is the creator. We know something essential about God, in fact, that Romans talks about in Romans chapter 1, that we're actually accountable for that kind of knowledge. Two, that man is somehow accountable as a creature of God to God, that we belong to him. Somehow there's an accountability to God. Three, that man, or me, I, am corrupt. That I have come to understand, somehow God has communicated to me that I have a problem. It's a serious problem before him. And that problem is that I am not worthy of being in his presence. That I am, at the very core of me, I have a critical, major, catastrophic flaw that results in my being a selfish, corrupt, and evil person. I'm not that all the time. But you poke me in the right place at the right time, and boy, does it pop out. I mean, it's there. You've been confronted with it. If you've confronted reality in other people, you know the corruption that lies at your core. That's the problem. And if you believe that and embrace it, that's part of this information that I think is sort of basic information that we need to understand. And the fourth thing is that God can and will fix it. God has an answer. God has a promise. Now, I think just in general terms that this package of information, this sort of general knowledge about God, in a most sort of generic sense, would characterize what Abraham understood, or what the people in Hebrews chapter 11 believed, even though they didn't have the full information about how God was going to fix it. And they believed this was true. This is the truth. Now, as we look at this information, it seems to me that we respond to it at two different levels. We see this we embrace this information at one level, personally, existentially, and in a critical manner. That is, we embrace it. We see this, and we either embrace it or we don't embrace it. We either fall before this truth and submit ourselves to it and say, yeah, that's truth, I believe that, or we don't. At the personal existential level, there's this this is my little symbol for an existential, personal, time, space, and history response to this truth. A momentary existential response to this truth. Is that true? Yes. There's another thing going on, it seems to me, that is that we all have views, world views. We all have views of reality that we have inherited and constructed as the things that we believe are true about things. These are things that are in this worldview, but if the worldview, the knowledge that we have, as in the case of Abraham and Old Testament characters, if the knowledge that we have in our worldview is incomplete, that is, it's still been in the process of being constructed and devised and edited, this knowledge here is something different than this existential personal response to this truth. In other words, here's the truth, this general truth about God and me. And I'm either personally, existentially engaged in embracing it and saying, I buy that. I need God because of my condition, or I'm not. But if I am, I also have a view of who God is and how he's going about doing what he's doing and how I fit into that picture that is, at varying levels in my life, complete or incomplete, correct or incorrect. And what I'm suggesting is that the critical issue about whether we really are believing God and trusting God and having what is biblical faith is that personal existential response to these basic fundamental truths. Our personal existential response to the issue of, do we love truth? Are we people who at the core of our lives, even though we know we can't do the truth, I try to do the truth and I fail, but I recognize it and I repudiate it, but I want the truth to be true of me. And I see the connection between that and my Creator God. If I get information about Jesus, if I'm that kind of person, I believe that kind of person would automatically would say, absolutely, that makes a whole lot of sense. In other words, how Jesus factors into the picture is that he is the means by which a God accomplished his promise, the effectiveness of his promise to us. But our knowledge of that is not what saves us. It's our existential, personal, believing, faith response to these fundamental facts about God, ourselves, and ultimately in our day, the knowledge of Jesus being who he is and how he fits into that picture is probably going to be there. But if it isn't there, and this being a person who wants the truth and is pursuing the truth, if that's actually happening, if and when the picture of Jesus, the knowledge of Jesus comes into the picture, I believe this person would say, oh, of course. That's how God's doing it. Okay? I'm going to close this statement by Simone Weil, who's a Jewish Catholic woman who died in New York on exile during World War II. Amazing person. She said this, "For it seems to me certain that one can never wrestle enough with God if one does so out of pure regard for truth, or for the truth. Christ likes us to prefer the truth to him, because before being Christ, he is the truth. Even if one turns aside from him to go toward what one perceives to be the truth, one will not go far before falling into his arms." I have found that true in my own life. There have been those moments and times when my understanding, I've come under the veil of serious doubt about some aspect of the faith, about some fact about God and me. In the midst of those crises moments, however, I really don't believe I've ever been at a place where I said, I really don't believe that anymore. I don't believe God is there. I don't believe that I'm accountable to him. I don't believe that I'm corrupt, and I don't believe that God fixes it. That's all true, but I'm having some crises issues with truth. There's some things that are bumping into my understanding of Christianity and my theology that are really rattling my cage. So there are those moments and there are those seasons. But even though I might have taken a rabbit trail for a while, the truth won out. And God's Spirit ultimately taught me the truth, brought me back to a clarification of the truth. And I think we all get into those kinds of processes. Well, I need to stop. I'm kind of beyond my terms here, but let me entertain a few questions if you have any. And
why do you think they translated logos as the word?
Well, that is the translation of that word.
I mean, if it is the all of these things you stated to me, that terms the, I mean, if it has all of those connotations, that it's a pregnant, loaded statement. Word doesn't translate necessarily with all of that. It doesn't carry with it in the translation all of that pregnant meaning.
Well, in this particular, did everybody hear the question? But why did, if the word in John 1 in the prologue is so full of all that stuff, why don't we have more of that stuff explicitly rather than just the word? It just seems to me that that's the way language works, that it's possible, and in this case it is the fact, that a word that is commonly used out there can become really loaded with, pregnant with these kinds of connotations and meanings, especially in a highly conceptual term like this that was used in Stoic philosophy, that it accumulates a field of meaning that has all those things packed into it, and it's all loaded into that one linguistic term. If you read philosophy or academic work, the character of a lot of that work is they don't use simple little, they don't use little words like that, or if they do, they understand that it is loaded, and you're going to have to unpack it. It wouldn't necessarily, and it doesn't, the word in some places in the Bible is simply a linguistic sign. So it's just in this case that John was using that kind of language. Any thoughts? Yes.
This kind of goes back to last week, but why should we believe John? Because as I understand that the Jesus seminar people kind of just disregard John altogether. So why entertain John?
Well, I don't know that I can answer it very well. I'm certainly not a scholar in those regards, in those issues. But my own quick response to it is that the Bible in general, the New Testament in particular, if you take the presupposition that the people who wrote these documents, these texts, were common sense, reasonable human beings who were really trying to just simply write histories about Jesus that were in fact interpretive, but were in fact accurate or truthful. That is, they weren't trying to lead anybody astray. They were trying to say what they actually saw, and they were trying to write down the implications, as they saw it, of Jesus' life, teachings, events, etc. If you don't take a skeptical view of those things, and you just take them, sort of grant assent to that, to their reasonableness and their integrity, then the textual problems that we have, the actual variations and problems in the text that we have handed down to us, which are copies of copies of copies of copies, that kind of thing, the amount of scholarship and evidence and research that has gone into those has found that that really the problem, the nature of the textual problems are on the order of having two words per page of the New Testament come under textual variance. That is, we don't know exactly what was there, and that the nature of those questions, the nature of the question is not theologically, factually significant. That is, there aren't any, is more along the lines of conjunctions and connections between sentences and things like that. That one author, that was one textual variant, shows this word being used, another one, and the words are just inconsequential ultimately in terms of the theology and the claims of truth that are being presented. So on the one hand, there's that. I don't think that we need to be to take the view that, as the Jesus Seminar does, that this is just basically constructed fiction. I don't think we have to go there at all. And secondly, the older I get, and the more my own life, by the grace of God, the more I see about myself, the more I see the truth about myself, the more I see the condition of man, the condition of the human being, the human heart and mind, the message itself, the nature of the message itself, just rings true. So on both levels, at the level of, is it reasonable, even scientifically, to embrace this? Yes, it is reasonable. And secondly, does it ring true? Does it somehow just penetrate to the core of who I am and answer my most desperate cries? I don't know of any other message that does. It's absolutely unique in its power to explain who I am and the world and the cosmos and what's wrong with all of us and what we need. So on both of those levels, that's why I believe it's true. Yes.
Well, when you quoted that lady, it was kind of saying, suggesting for me to love truth over Jesus, and that naturally I would eventually fall in Jesus' arms. So can you think of any danger for Christians to love Jesus over truth?
That's an interesting question. Did you all hear that? In a sense, no, I don't think there's any danger in that if I have the right Jesus. Because there are a lot of Jesuses out there. And there are a lot of pictures of this Jesus that are inaccurate. But if I have the real Jesus, if I have the New Testament, if an actual understanding, true understanding of the New Testament Jesus and what he taught, I don't think there's any danger. On the other hand, if I have a constructed, fictional Jesus, if I have a Jesus, for example, I remember a long time ago, somebody saying that one of the problems that we always face is that we're capable of constructing a picture of Jesus that's a reflection of us. It's like we think we're looking through a window and we're actually looking in a mirror. And it strikes me that the danger would be that we have a picture of Jesus that, for example, I've heard pictures of Jesus or portraits of Jesus or his teachings that are very, that wouldn't include the kind of stuff that I was talking tonight about the connection between Jesus and all truth. I've heard here and there, read here and there, portraits of Jesus that in which Jesus is presented with as someone whose teachings do not permit me to understand the fullness of and the complexity and the beauty of my humanness that he created, that he made, that God made in me. So I guess that's my quick response to that. Yes, in the sense if we have the right one. Dangerous if we have a false one. And there are a lot of false ones floating around in the name of Christianity, I think. The others? Yes?
On the board here, you kind of discussed the difference between sort of knowledge and then belief, mm-hmm. or in Abraham's case where he actually acted on mm-hmm. what he believed. The four things, the four truths you have up there, do you believe those are known by all people?
That's an interesting question. I guess my quick response to that is my mind goes immediately to Romans 1:16 and following, where that passage where it talks about the creature being condemned because that there's a knowledge about God that's available in creation. It seems to me that that language right there is very condemning in the sense that the wrath of God revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and the unrighteousness of men who suppress the truth in unrighteousness because that which is known about God is evident within them, for God made it evident to them or evident among them or around them. For since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes, his eternal power, his divine nature have been clearly seen without being understood through what has been made so that they are without excuse. In other words, the whole idea here is that God has a just case against human beings for the knowledge that is available to them in creation, and in fact our response to that knowledge is we suppress it, we push it away. Especially the kind of knowledge, I mean it's one thing to, that's the thing, the Bible's, when we talk about the Bible's truth, we're talking about a critical core of truth that has to do with man's being, existence, and destiny, and his source of origin, and his accountability to the Creator God who is there. It's that truth. It's not truth about butterflies and how to make art and that kind of stuff. So it's that kind of truth. And that kind of truth, the corrupt, evil creature, according to the Bible and according to my own experience, is the kind of truth that I tend to say, ooh, you know, it's... I don't leap out for it. I actually go like that because it condemns me. I mean, it shows me for what I am. So your question again is, do you think everybody has that? At some level, it seems to me this passage is implying that. At some level, it's available to us.
At least point number one.
Yeah. Okay, thanks a lot.